Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 4th, 2018, and welcome to episode 167 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, corrections, whatever it is, shooting buffalo.
Corrections like in the penal sense?
Yes, right. Rehabilitation.
Speaking of which, we have a guest today.
That's right. So, I'm Paul Hagstrom. I'm in Boston. The person who you just heard talking is Carrington Manson, who is in Toronto. But he is not our guest today. Neither is Jack Nutting in Stockholm.
Nope.
Our guest today is Quinn Dunkey in Los Angeles. So I'll start with you, Quinn. How are you?
Hello. I am excellent. And as is tradition on RCR, I guess I'm supposed to talk about the weather.
Yes.
And it's lovely here because it's Los Angeles and it's 72 and sunny 360 days a year.
Yeah.
Which is why people live here.
It's not like that here, but oh well. All right, Jack, how's the weather out there?
I think we should actually mention that we are talking about the weather and what we say that the podcast is about. It was just throw it right in there. But anyway, the weather is cold and pretty terrible. It's been like minus... Oh, okay. We're going Celsius here. So like last week, we had a lot of days that were like minus 10 Celsius. What's that? Say around 10 Fahrenheit. It's cold.
Yeah, it's coldish.
Yeah, I mean it could be worse. It's not Minnesota cold, but it's cold.
Right. So. All right, Carrington, how's Toronto?
I have not been outside because okay. I'm a real computer programmer. Right. Not you, like you phony people who've seen the sun. Actually, I don't know. It's minus something outside in Toronto today, but it's not snowing, so that's okay.
Perfect. Yeah, here, actually, it's we had another bomb cyclone. That's pretty cool. But
that sounds like something out of a Super Mario game.
I know. It was very windy. But
do you bounce off it? Do you get coins?
Paul has been rocket jumping to the store again.
Right, exactly. Double jump and I can make it. I had to go to two Targets today to get the thing that I'll talk about when we get to the gift idea. But anyway, that's almost a double jump. So I am nominally in charge of the host's topic today, and the host topic today is going to be sort of continuing from last time's host topic, where we were talking about kind of homebrew projects and kind of logistical problems in making them and getting them made and making them work and making them available and keeping them available and making, you know, pricing and all of those things those of us who are on the podcast speculated wildly about things we knew little about. and so we got some feedback. So that was cool.
Oh, you got feedback.
Thank you for the feedback, everybody. I think the short version of what we were hypothesizing would be possible would be a website with a little button that you could click that says, build me one of these and send it to me. And, you know, it was a little bit more nuanced and interesting than that. But that turns out not to be a very viable way for things to work. But I think there's a lot of stuff that is interesting to talk about in this space. And so one of the advantages of having Quinn here today is that she's done a fair amount of this kind of like fabrication stuff. So we can hear at least about how that worked for her. So maybe Quinn, if you had like things you were thinking about, you know, like for example, from the email you sent.
Yeah, it turns out if you write a strongly worded enough email, they just tell you to come on the show and talk about it. I'm sure I'm one of at least two people who were screaming furiously at their podcast device this whole time. Because it is one of those things where if you've never done any electronics manufacturing, it sounds sort of vaguely plausible that, I should be able to have some sort of board description file and a list of materials, and some factory in Asia should just be able to produce it. But as with so many things, the devil is in the details. I guess the thesis of the problem could be described as electronics manufacturing is a very iterative process. You know, while there are standardized file formats for describing each step in the process, actually the execution of those things has a lot of room for error and a lot of room for interpretation. And what you get back from the factory, you will never be quite what you expected. And you always have to go back and forth several times. So that's sort of the first primary barrier. And there are a lot of designs, you know, in the retro community that frankly no factory could probably build, or at least no factory could get the parts for. So let me start back at the beginning. You guys are talking about file formats. So those are fairly standardized. A factory is going to expect a board file, a Gerber file, and a drill file. And those are the files needed to produce the circuit board. And that is sufficiently standardized and rigorous that you can, you know, upload those files to somewhere like Oshpark and click a button and you get a PCB, and that PCB is going to work. And that part is okay. When it comes to actual assembly, then you're going to supply a bill of materials. There isn't a good standard for the definition of that document. And specifying components is actually very difficult because part numbers vary by manufacturer. No two factories can obtain the same types of parts. Often a part you need isn't available. The parts that you need might be in too small a supply. Often assembly houses will have a list of factory or house parts that they expect you to build your device from. So all of these sorts of things. And then the devices you get back are likely to have errors. They may not work. There might be assembly mistakes. They might have substituted a part without telling you because they couldn't get one, and so they found one that they felt was equivalent but actually isn't. There may be counterfeit parts in there, which is an increasing problem. So these are all the sorts of things that are sort of standing in the way of this one-click, send me a widget idea.
So as you're saying that, I was wondering if the things you're talking about are basically like for even for just like modern projects. Like if you wanted to make a modern project with modern components, you could do this. Would it be... How viable does it seem to have kind of like a retro computing specialist, you know, not in Asia, but just like in New Jersey or something, who decided that that's what they're going to do, or they're going to help the retro computing community? Maybe that's just not something a person could do, but like if there was kind of like a business model where they're going to be the people who help the other people build their stuff.
I think there could be something there. I think ironically, it's actually easier to do this with modern devices because newer devices are more available and a little more standardized. But I think the problems with building these retro devices are always going to be down to supply chain. I wasn't the only person who wrote in about this. Of course, I should mention listener Dale, who wrote in quite a detailed email about a lot of the stuff that we've mentioned here. And, you know, one of the things that he rightfully points out is that a lot of retro projects need things like 7400 series logic or 5 volt tolerant FPGAs or CPLDs or, you know, 5 volt SRAM chips or SRAMs in small sizes. And these are things that even, you know, a retro computing specialist is going to have trouble getting. And a lot of the stuff nobody makes anymore. So it's all new old stock. Or a lot of times the inventories of the part suppliers are procedurally generated, and they don't actually represent what they have. So a lot of times, you know, a supplier will list stuff on their site with the assumption that they can get it if anyone wants it. You know, they're acting as kind of middlemen, and that's never clear. So, you know, we saw this with the Apple II disk port connectors, the big foo-for-all over those. There were dozens of electronics component and connector suppliers that listed that on their sites, but if you placed an order, it would just never be filled because they couldn't actually get them. They just thought they probably could if anybody asked. So there's a lot of that. So it's very difficult to source the parts and know what's even sourceable. So a lot of the parts would end up coming from eBay or something like that. So this hypothetical person in New Jersey would have to commit to building X number of something, possibly not even knowing if the parts can be obtained, or I think that it would end up being so obscenely expensive that nobody would buy the product, you know. I think that building, you know, a couple of hundred of a lot of these retro devices would end up costing so much that people wouldn't pay that for the device retail, but people don't understand why it costs so much. So they just aren't, you know, our cost expectation for electronics is at a certain level. We expect a device of whatever X size and X features to cost Y. And if it costs, you know, Y times 10, people just won't buy it.
Right, right. Yeah. That's always been kind of an issue, like looking at these things and people complaining about how expensive they are. And yeah. I mean, I also find them expensive, but I understand at least. I feel like, you know, it doesn't seem right to be angry about the expense. But yeah. Also, it turns out I was using the wrong microphone, so hopefully I sound different now.
You sound expensive.
Yes. Excellent. In case I can't edit that back, you know, into something sensible, I didn't turn on my microphone. So, cool. Anyway, Jack, was there any thoughts you had on this?
Not really. I think I'm glad to sort of hear all of the reasons why my pie in the sky idea doesn't actually work. Because it seemed too easy. And that clearly it's not. Mm. I guess it still seems like some of those things could be, you know, like you were saying, Paul, you know, if there's someone who's specializing in this, you know, if there are certain common items that are frequently needed for specific Apple II projects, that sort of thing, that somebody could, you know, have, you know, buy up 100,000 of these things and then they would have them. And so, that would have to be someone that's kind of a specialty operator. People who are doing modern construction of new things, like the existing shops today, probably will not think in those terms. Like, right. Why would they do that? So,
yeah, I know. I mean, like, I guess the trick in all of these cases is that's a lot of outlay at the beginning. So
right.
Reactive Micro, I think, is the company that I was not quite able to bring my, you know, mouth around to saying last time, but they're the ones who make the universal power supply kit, and they have actually been partnering with a couple of other people for Apple II related stuff mainly. I don't think they're building them, but they're providing them. But I suspect they would also, you know, to a limited extent, be at least helpful in finding places to help build things, even if they aren't building things themselves. I like the model that they're putting forward, and I don't know what actually is out there in the non Apple II space, but there probably are other similar kinds of things. They just picked up Breel Computer, so they're the ones who made the Replica One and a couple of other things. They are going to now sell those through the Reactive Micro Store, so that's cool to have some of that's an example of something that was available and then went away because the person who was making them was just a person and got busy. So.
Yeah, I think you touched on something that shouldn't be underestimated there. I was talking about people's cost expectation, and the supply chain is only half of that. You know, our cost expectation for electronics is largely based on extremely inexpensive labor, you know, in Asian countries. And so the amount of labor in building a lot of these things, unless you're willing to, you know, invest in a $50,000 pick and place machine and, you know, a $100,000 wave solder for through hole, like all these sorts of things, you're talking enormous amounts of labor, you know, and labor in first world countries is extremely expensive. So, mm-hmm. you know, you might be talking about $500 in labor to build something that people would only pay $100 for.
Right. I mean, actually another sort of aspect. Oh, hi, Carrington.
Hello.
Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah. My company owns a, or my company, my family has a custom fabrication company in Toronto. We do metal fab, not electronics fab. But a lot of what everybody's been talking about is applicable. Mostly we deal with, you know, companies in oil industry and that kind of stuff who need a custom, you know, oil cooler. And we do one-off fab of that. But also a lot of people come in and just want something for their truck. they see something in the store, they want a custom version. And the rule of thumb is anything you can buy, we can make, but it starts at 15 times the cost. And it's more likely to be 20 to 25. So if you buy it, you can go into Home Depot and buy it for $100. For $1,500, I can make you one that's custom for you. And that would be our starting cost. And most of the time, the conversation ends there. But that's just the nature of like a company who knocks them out by the tens of thousands in China can do it differently than we have. You know, Steve in the back will start custom forming that for you. And, you know, if it means a lot, great. And if you need that special thing for your truck or your house or your business or your restaurant, and it's got to be custom, then no problem. We can make anything you want. But the cost conversation normally has to come first because that's just the nature of custom fab or small fabrication. And it's got to be the same thing for electronics, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've looked at this issue a lot because I've done some retro computing type things. I did my custom ROM for the 2C Plus, and you know, that was right at the limit of where it was worth doing. I made 50 of them and I sold them, you know, at KFest for a price people were willing to pay. But you know, I broke even on that on the labor for sure. I didn't make any money. But you know, I've got other projects like that. I've got a ROM programmer and various other Apple II things that I could turn into a product. I've also got other hobbies where I've done the math on this. I do machine shop stuff and I do metal fabrication stuff as well. And every time I sit down and do the math, what I would have to charge for the outcome to just pay the mortgage for the space that I'm in to do it, I couldn't break even. So it just never works out. And so I keep my job and go back to work.
There were a couple of things I was thinking about one way to make people a little happier with the price is to have them do more of it themselves, right? So I'm wondering if there are sort of like, rather than prefabrication, like single button, you know, make me one of these things, maybe some kind of an organized community effort to say like, these are the board fabricators that I've had good luck with. This is what I've had to do. You know, here's a design that works with that fabricator for this thing. If you wanted to start with that, and here's where I found my parts and that kind of stuff. So that you're still doing some of it, but there's help. Because I know that, I mean, I haven't really tried to do this, so maybe there's some of that out there already. But I kind of feel like there's probably too much out there. Like I don't know how to find the right one because there's 1,500 places with information that conflicts.
Yeah, I think what you're describing there is basically a fixer, right? That's who you need in the middle. And there are people that do that. You know, Bunny Wang, kind of a famous one. You know, he designed and built an open source laptop and a lot of other really high-tech custom hacking stuff. And he's written a lot of articles. I think he may even have written a book about how to build custom small-run things in Asian factories. And you know, yeah, that's sort of his deal, is that he can help people do that. He knows all the factory owners and he knows who's good and who's not and what parts they can get and so on. But yeah, that role is a full-time job for sure. I don't know if anyone would do it for retro stuff is the thing. I think the market's just too small.
Right. And also probably not on a volunteer basis.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah. And the market is small and shrinking, frankly. So
that's right.
It may not be viable.
Yeah. Part of what I was thinking about, but what led me to think about this was the CFFA 3000 cards. They do seem to be at this point, you know, mature enough that he was able to just make a big order. I mean, I think it was still, you know, a little bit iterative. Like he got some samples and tested them and then got the rest. But I don't think he's building any of them this time.
Yeah, that's true. It sounds like he's got it a little bit dialed in. But yeah, even with that, I mean, this is his fifth iteration of this. And even still, he had issues like the first 100 of the remotes had the covers didn't fit, you know, and things like that. So even now, it's a constant battle. You know, I have friends who work in toy manufacturing and for Mattel, and that's, you know, they've been doing it for 50 years and they still have that issue. Like every so often a run of Barbie dolls will just be wrong and they have to go over to Asia and get it fixed. And so it's never ending. It's never going to be just push a button and it works every time, I don't think.
Wrong or extra collectible?
Exactly right. That's three arms.
Yeah, I'm sure they never see the light of day, but yeah, I would love to know the things that go wrong with them. Could be horrifying.
Horrifying or extra collectible.
I will say that there are companies that do kind of related work. Like if you want to make a modern product, you know, in not a huge run, there are companies like Flextronics in the Bay Area. That's kind of their deal, is that they will take your design and they will manufacture it. If you just want to make like 500 of them to see if it's viable, see if there's a market for what you want to do. When I was freelancing, I had a client who had a Bluetooth fitness device that you put on your bike helmet, and I wrote the app for them that connected to it. And so that, you know, they went through Flextronics, who, you know, they made 100, and then they made 500, and then okay, it seems like this product has a market, so let's make 1,000. So they kind of help you get to cross that gap from, you know, 5 prototypes that you built by hand to 100,000 that you can ship, you know, to stores. Bridging that gap is really challenging, and so there are companies that do that. But again, it's a very iterative process, and they're using all modern components where it's sort of feasible to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that we did actually talk about, you know, sometime in the past the problem with those DB19 connectors that big mess of wires. I'm not actually sure. I guess he had them made, but you know, there was a while where they were just out.
He did end up actually getting a factory to make him a run of those things. And he posted a picture, may have tweeted or something at one point, of the shipment in his living room. And it's like 50 boxes of these things. So he has like 10,000 of them, because that was the smallest number he could get anyone to make. Yeah. So that's, you know, if you need some of those, I'm sure he'd be happy to sell them to you.
Right. So I think pretty common for a lot of early Apple products, and I think Amiga too or something. There were a couple of different platforms that used that. So, I mean, it's still small. I'm sure he still has some left.
Yeah, I suspect so. Yeah, we have the same problem with Apple II joysticks. They use 150-ohm potentiometer, which was a slightly non-standard but widely available size in 1980, and now it's unobtainium. They just, nobody makes them anymore, and so there's lots, you know, there's ways around it, different designs you can do, but it's another good example of that problem.
Yeah, excellent. All right, maybe we can move on to the next section, which is listener feedback, apart from the feedback that we got about our previous topic, at least. Okay, so I'll just run through. There's actually a huge amount here. So anyone who wants to say anything about what I'm saying, jump in. We got, I think it was just after we recorded the previous one, so this is coming at a very late moment, but Cooper wrote over email to say that there's going to be a retro computer meetup in Central Florida, in Altamonte Springs, I guess, is on Saturday, March 10th. So hopefully this is even published by then. If you happen to be in that area and can get there and didn't already know about this, there is a Facebook page for the group that is holding the event, and I think you have to join that page before you can then see the event. But at any rate, if you're in Central Florida, there's an attempt at a meetup type thing. Okay, Michael of RCR wrote to us over email to suggest looking at a crowdfunding campaign to keep the bomb at Bletchley Park. Basically, they're looking for, let's see, what are they looking for? £50,000. They have raised £23,000 so far. There are 9 days left, so I'm a little concerned about this. But it is a working reconstruction of the Turing-Welchman machine that helped break enemy Enigma messages in the Second World War. So basically, just they need funding to rehouse it in a new place. Anyway, if you're interested in that, I think we might even include a clip of this in the ad space.
I'm pretty sure we talked about this before at some point.
The machine.
This reconstruction, yeah. Uh-huh. And it'd be cool if they could keep it where they are building it. Not having watched the video, I don't know what the issue is, but it'd be a bummer if they suddenly can't keep it there anymore where they've been working on building it.
Yeah, my quick skim here does not reveal what it is that they lack currently, but you know, perhaps they're just like running out of rent or something.
That's disappointing. I'm surprised the UK government wouldn't just step in a situation like that. I mean, that's clearly an extremely valuable historical artifact.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, when we're talking sort of government sized entities, £50,000 is probably not that much. Well, anyway, we'll keep an eye on it. I think we will know by, you know, whatever the outcome was by the next time we record. Another bit of feedback that we got was from Tony over email. He was commenting on our discussion of the Cocoa enhancement cartridge from last time that I didn't understand at all. And Jack sort of filled me in on, but the idea was that it's like a platform, a sort of enhancement platform that goes inside a cartridge. So if you're producing cartridges, you can use this to get better sound and stuff like that. And he wonders if games could be written to take advantage of that cartridge in a different slot. So there's, you know, using something like a Cocoa multipack, which he says allows you to select between like 1 and 4 different cartridges. When I read that email, I thought, so I don't know the Cocoa, but my initial guess as to what that multipack is not that it allows access to 4 cartridges at once, but that it just, you know, electrically connects 1 of 4. Does anyone know? Carrington, did you have a multipack?
I had a Cocoa, but I do not know about the cartridge.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. My guess would be the same as yours, Paul, but I do not know.
Hmm.
I have an Aquarius, there is a kind of like a multi-cartridge thing for that, and that actually is designed for you to put like a RAM cartridge in one and then a game in another. But anyway, could be. Yeah, I mean, like, my concern with this, just it sort of seemed like that's just a whole lot of redundant, you know, better sound chips out there. But maybe that's not that big of a concern. Anyway, Tony sort of continued kind of talking about other things, like the Commodore 1541 drive being so slow because it had a whole controller in it, and then goes back to promoting the Cocoa, saying, well, the Cocoa, you know, had a separate controller from the drive, so it was much faster. Also, and the BASIC is more elegant than Apples and Commodores, he says. So I think I know where he stands.
It was a great BASIC. I'll give him that.
Yeah, I think, well, the 1541's issue was that it had a serial connection more than anything, and also a particularly bad one because there was actually a part of the serial line that they didn't hook up properly in the factory. But yeah, regarding the Cocoa enhancement cartridge, I would echo what Earl said last time, which is that it's hard enough to get people to write retro software as it is, so asking them to also write it for a device that almost nobody has, I think, is probably a fool's errand.
Yeah. Yeah, it does sort of seem like, you know, when you get to a point where, like, your game only runs on an accelerated, you know, an enhanced machine, why don't you just write a game for, like, a modern machine?
Yeah.
It's much easier.
There are some limited exceptions. Like, I think you can assume an accelerator for 2GS games, for example, because everybody has an accelerator for them, and they're increasingly easy to get. But, yeah, for anything else, I think the chicken and egg problem there is insurmountable. I mean, it was largely insurmountable at the time. I mean, how many games support, you know, mocking boards, and lots of Apple II users had those things. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I think nowadays it's 10 times worse.
Indeed. Also, Michael from RCR sent over email. He pointed out a sad tweet. Cindy Moya posted a photo of a teletype that had arrived at the Living Computer Museums and Labs. It's very sad. The caption says, "Incorrectly packaged teletype received." And, you know, you can imagine, these are heavy, heavy things. And it's a very, very cracked case there. So I suppose this actually, you know, that's what we could do. We could, next time we could have our topic be, you know, shipping companies we have been angry at. Or actually, shippers, packers. Because I've had an Apple IIc monitor arrive that looks a little bit like this, because it was pretty much like thrown in a box with like some plastic bags. what are people thinking? Anyway, so sorry to see that, because apparently it was, you know, looked nice pre-shipping. But Bill posted on Facebook, and actually, if you're on any of these retro computing Facebook groups, he will have posted on everything that has even the slightest hint of a relationship to Apple. The announcement that Call Apple, it was a big user group, and then also had a magazine that went along with it, and they've published their 40th anniversary issue. So it's available to members, and it's largely about the history of the organization, and quite a lot about Val Golding, who's one of the initial editors. Anyway, if you're interested in that, congratulations on the 40th anniversary of that. Did we just scoop up an apple again?
probably. I'm sure it's fine.
Sorry.
we're used to it.
There was a weird thing that someone posted on the Facebook group. I had never seen this before. Maybe it was just me that didn't know about it, but there is an imminent release of some kind of, seems to be a game / maybe interactive movie or something that is an adaptation of War Games. And, you know, I think an officially licensed one that is coming out on March 14th. I don't know even how to begin thinking about this. But is this not news to anybody? Like, have you seen this before?
No. Wait, yes.
I don't know how to answer the question. I don't understand it.
Affirmative.
Okay. Yeah. What can anybody tell me about this? How's that?
I've never heard of it.
I'd never heard of Echo either. EKO, the company that's hosting it at HelloEcho.com. I guess it's going to be a web series of some sort, maybe. I don't know this company. I don't know this thing.
Yeah.
So I think I've heard of the company that they make these interactive videos where there are branches. So you're not just watching a video. You can make some kind of choices. So kind of like a...
So it's the return of full motion video games.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
I'm totally okay with that, actually.
Yeah, because those were great.
Those were always amazing. Every one of them. Pure gold.
Yeah.
What was the one in the Sega Genesis? The Sega
CD? Night Trap.
Oh, God, that was horrible.
Whenever you talk about interactive movies, Night Trap always comes up.
In college, Paul, you know Nils Johnson. He sat and he tried to map out everything in that game so he could try and beat it. Maybe he did it, too. But man, what a waste of time.
That game is legendarily bad. Looking back on it now, it's hard to believe anything like that was ever produced.
I mean, one of the things I don't know about this War Games thing is... I mean, you know, so it was posted on the Facebook group as, you know, the sort of obvious kind of thought was like, you know, what are the odds? I think it was like, what are the odds this is going to be good? You know, like that they're going to ruin War Games in some way. But I have a hard time even connecting this in my mind. I mean, like, so A, I'm almost certain that this is not going to be very related to the War Games we know, right?
Right.
I mean, I think somebody's name is Lightman. That might be. But and the other thing is, I don't know why is this a selling point? Like, who is it that's playing this game now that was like born when War Games was out? It seems like I don't understand why it was worth even trying to build this off the initial property. Anyway, but nevertheless, I'll probably look at it. So maybe it's worked, but I don't know. Anyway, we'll see. March 14th. I think that's that'll be before our next recording, so. Two more feedback bits. Mark of the Atari Lynx Handycast wrote over Twitter to point out that... last time we talked about the TI Compact Computer 40, he wrote... So one of the issues about that was that it basically has no connection to the outside world, and, you know, they were going to have some sort of wafer tape drive thing that never actually got produced, and so there are a couple of things that you can plug into it, a modem and a RS-232, but there's no sort of permanent storage. So Mark wrote in to point out that John Guidry and Jim Brain have been working on accessories for this, and there's a thread on the Atari Age forums that it's a very long thread that's been going on for a very long time, but it seems like the discussion near the end does include things being, you know, released to beta testers and things like that, that would work as RAM expanders and storage devices. So that's sort of interesting. And it might also be interesting to check out the Atari Lynx Handycast that he is hosting. That we'll have the link there in the show notes. And I think we mentioned his another podcast that he did called Tube Tunes a while ago, which I think was it's like theme songs from television, I believe. It's the theme of that. Maybe I'll just... Oh, go ahead.
The Atari Lynx, I'm going to say, is the Amiga of handheld gaming systems. It was slightly technically ahead of its time, and the fans of it are rabid, and it was doomed to fail for reasons aside from the technology, and the fans of it are all still super, super mad about it.
I see. Cool. So it's a likely a rage-filled podcast. So, Jack, weren't you on both those platforms, right?
No, I never had a Lynx. Oh, okay. A friend of mine had one, but I never had one. I was very interested in it, but I don't know. I was in college and I was had other expenses. But yeah, it would be fun to pick one up nowadays, I think. But they're pretty expensive.
I had one back in the day and I quite liked it.
Oh, really? Cool. Yeah, I did not. I did. So, and part of why the CC40 came up is that I got a relatively cheap one on eBay. That has arrived. I haven't done anything except, you know, look at it. But actually last night I lost a whole bunch of auctions for the peripherals because they really are in demand. So I still have no way to connect this to the outside world, but oh well. It's pretty promising that it does seem like this is a pretty good place to do one of those kind of like modern projects that connect to old computers. Cause it's, there is a hex bus, you know, there's a thing, you know, a interface. So anyway, we'll see. I will watch that with interest and report on it when something happens. And then let's see, the last thing I will mention is that, Mark wrote in, different Mark. This is Mark of Nox Archaeist, who we heard from a couple of times ago. Apparently it got the top spot in a Projects of 2017 poll on the Ultima Codex. So this is, I think this is, you know, for Ultima fans, diehards or whatever, I think the Ultima Codex is where you gather. And so there was a vote for the favorite fan project and Nox Archaeist made it, on top with 120 votes. I don't know most of these other things. Lawless Legend is another, Apple II based game that's been, in the works for a while, and that made it, I don't know what that is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th. So, congratulations on that. And hopefully we'll hear more about both of those soon.
Yes, in a couple of hours, in fact, when we record Open Apple, and we're going to talk about all these things.
Oh, okay. You don't want to talk about it now, then.
Yeah. I'm not going to scoop my own show, no.
Come on, do it.
I will say that the security on that poll was extremely dubious, and I may have voted 4 times for not okay. Contest.
You heard it okay. Here first, folks.
And also Lawless Legends. I drove them both up the charts single-handedly, I think.
Excellent, yeah. I've come across the codex a couple of times, just sort of like looking for things. And I'm still a backer of the new whatever it is, Shroud of the Avatar.
Yeah.
But you know, I backed it initially because I felt guilty, you know. So I thought, all right, well, you know, since I made copies of Ultima back in the 80s, I will back this project now. But it's still. Even now, after it's been going for however long it's been, a couple of years, I think, it doesn't have support for, like the controls that I have on my laptop. So I think it doesn't have you need a multi-button mouse. So I still haven't really played it, but anyway, whatever.
Yeah, I'm interested in it because I'm a huge Ultima Online fan, and this feels like the first true successor to that. And I follow Richard Garriott on Twitter, and he has been posting a lot of interesting things about it. But I just don't have time for MMOs anymore.
Yeah. All right. I think we made it. We made it through the feedback. Thank you, everybody, for feeding back. So now we can turn to the items of interest and news, which is, as usual, not super distinct from feedback. But Carrington, you have the first one.
I do? Okay, cool. Then I am going to talk about the Grand Digital, which is an odd name for an odd thing. The National Computer Museum of Computing, whatever it's called, the National Museum of Computing, that's it, over in the UK, they held something called the Grand Digital, which was a race between a bunch of computers spanning a bunch of decades. So there was one from the 1940s, a calculator. There was a PDP-8, an Apple II, a BBC Micro, I think I'm late 90s Windows PC, and they were all racing for 15 seconds to compute as many numbers in a Fibonacci sequence as they could. So that's the thing where the next number is the sum of the two preceding ones, so 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, that's what everyone has memorized, and then it would be 21 after that, he says, doing quick math. But anyway, that thing. So I'm quicker than some of these computers, apparently. Backed or they said there might be some dark horses in the race. It was a big deal, and everyone's saying, well, obviously you think that the most modern computer will do the best, but we're all hoping that 9-year-old Connie on the BBC micro bit does the best. No, 9-year-old Connie won. I think this was rigged, but whatever. Yeah. The iPhone 6 also competed, but it did so with somebody speaking the request into it by Siri. So it only calculated, I think, 2 or 3 numbers. So it's like, what's the next number, Siri? And then it comes up, what's the next? Anyway, so they hobbled a couple of the modern ones, I think. But it's a neat thing. They're hoping to do a bunch of these. This is the first of the maybe annual or monthly or something. But the idea is just to gather different micros together, or in some cases macros, the which was involved, and have them do something in some form of race, not necessarily to make it fair, but just to make it fun, introduce a range of people to a very wide range of computers and computing forms. And I think in that sense it was successful, and it gets the NMOC into the news, which it quite likes to do, and we like it too because it gives us something to talk about. So everybody wins here, including 9-year-old Connie, who I think should be drug tested. But
yeah, the thing about the Siri is a little bizarre. I think they talked about this on Retro Mountcast. I knew I'd heard about
it. They scooped us.
Yeah. All I remember hearing about was the Siri thing. I think this was before the actual event happened. So
they were in on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it happened end of February, February 20th, 21st, something like that. So it's relatively recent. But well done, 9-year-old Connie.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Even if it was rigged, is still pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it was still neat, and she wrote the software. Like she wrote the software herself to run on the BBC micro bit, which is itself a really neat thing. So the fact that the micro bit was in the running and did it, and that a 9-year-old just stepped up and she just wrote the code, and the whole thing is super fun. So I'm happy to promote it. We'll have a link to the official press release from the NMOC in the show notes.
Cool. I would like to try a micro bit someday.
I have played with it a little bit, and it was pretty fun.
Uh-huh.
There are like a couple of different environments. One, you can either write in kind of like a Scratch-like environment, which all runs in JavaScript, and the other way was to run it in Python. And I spent about a day messing with it, and I made kind of a very, very simple sort of game on the tiny, tiny display. And I first did it using the Scratch-like environment, and later, like I got so irritated because that's just a terrible way to write software. So I redid it in Python instead, and I figured that the performance difference between these two was about 40 times, whatever the Scratch thing was doing, so many levels of indirection through JavaScript and everything else that just like it was making something enormous and heavy, too much for it to really deal with properly.
Well, it connects to the internet and it sends voice commands to a Siri server.
Right.
Anyway, it's a cool little device. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, I'll have to, at some point, see if I can get one on this side of the ocean. Anyway, okay, Jack, you have the next thing here.
Yeah, so there's this old game called Stunt Car Racer, alternately Stunt Track Racer at times, that I remember playing on the Amiga. This was a pretty popular game on the Amiga and on the Atari ST, and I guess on some of these more British things, the Amstrad and the Speccy. And I guess there was also a Commodore 64 version and an MS-DOS version, but who played those? I don't know. But the important thing is that now it's been ported to the Atari 8-bits, and it looks pretty cool. I haven't tried it. I looked at the video, and the video looks actually, it doesn't look as good as the Amiga version I remember playing, but it looks pretty good. One of the great things about this game that I remember when I played it was you could connect two computers, two Amigas, with an L modem cable and both be in the same game. This was, you know, this is before people commonly had a lot of networking on these devices. So playing head-to-head on two different computers was kind of a novelty. And it worked really well. I don't know if that works on any of the other platforms at all. That may only be an Amiga or an ST thing. But anyway, I thought it was pretty neat. And apparently someone had taken the Commodore 64 version basically imported it to the Atari 8-bit. So, looks pretty fun.
That head-to-head novelty is not to be underestimated. Back in back in those days, we had on the Apple II, there was this game called Modem Wars, which some of you may remember, allowed you to connect to one other person with a modem, and it was basically drawn light cycles, but over the modem with a real human. And there was something so incredibly compelling about that that we used to play that for hours on end, and people now would laugh at the experience, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting when you first get to connect out of that, out of your little basement room or whatever.
Mm.
All right, let's see. The next thing that I have, so I don't know how new this is. I think the reason that came to my attention is because there was an update or something like that. I think this has been around for a while, but there is a ZX Spectrum emulator called ZX Beremulator. It's an emulator on a Raspberry Pi. And so the subtitle says a ZX Spectrum, S-P-I-C-T-R-U-M, which makes it sound like it's from New Zealand. But at any rate, I think it's actually...
Tessa, is that you?
Right. I don't know what this is. It might be Portuguese?
I think it's Spanish. I think it is Spanish. I'm not sure, but I think...
Yeah, maybe actually now that I look at it, maybe that is a little bit more Spanish-y and less Portuguese-y. Okay, anyway, whatever. If you keep scrolling down, if you would prefer to read this in English, there's an English version near the bottom. But the main thing is it's a ZX Spectrum emulator for a Raspberry Pi, and it does not work through an underlying Linux installation. It actually is sort of bare metal, which is why hence the name ZX Bare Emulator. And so you install it on your Raspberry Pi, and then you can it can do I think certain things. You need to connect a USB game controllers and a keyboard. It warns you that you have to connect it before you turn it on, because there's it's got sort of a limited device discovery ability. Anyway, it looks pretty cool, and it looks pretty cool that this was designed in a bare metal way. So that's always the thing people say about the using a Raspberry Pi for emulation, and particularly for sort of hardware interfacing, is that you can't really control what it's doing timing wise because there's so many processes running, and this is this is just a ZX Spectrum. So I tried, I wanted to see what it was like, but I didn't have any Raspberry Pis on hand. So I went and tried to install. I spent a bunch of time trying to install a Raspberry Pi emulator so that I could try to install the ZX Spectrum emulator on it. And I didn't quite succeed before now, but hopefully. Actually, now that I am where I record this, I have a whole bunch of Raspberry Pis upstairs, so I can just try it for real when we're done recording. But anyway, it seemed kind of interesting, and the ZX Spectrum is something that I've wanted for a while, but there's minor obstacles, I need to convert the power in the video, and they're not super available in North America. So, anyone going to try this?
No.
Okay. I should say, so... I know, Quinn, you're relatively, Carrington too, Apple-focused, but the colors on the ZX Spectrum are just a sight to behold.
That's a polite description.
They're wonderful. They're so saturated and bright.
I don't know if the Apple II has any moral high ground on color palette, but even for us, the Spectrum is, I find it hard to look at. But I will say it's really impressive I've played and seen a lot of specy games, and it is quite amazing how people work around those limits.
Uh-huh.
It has weird constraints, you can only use certain colors in certain quadrants of the screen or whatever. There's very strange limits on it, even stranger than the Apple II in some ways.
Huh. I always find that hilarious because I was relatively unfamiliar with the specy. And when you play games on it, even in emulation, the whole... as your character walks under the ladder, now you're yellow. Because of course you are. Why? It's just the color palettes, I don't even really understand what's going on, but clearly has a whole bunch of limitations. But the yellows and the pinks are quite vibrant.
Yeah.
And that cyan, it just says hello.
But if you're ever tempted to judge the spectrum harshly, take a look at the motherboard sometime. There's like, that whole computer is like three chips. It's astonishing how much it does for what's inside it.
Cool. Yeah, someday I'll actually get one. But I think I am hoping that I can get this installed and running, if not in an emulator, because that's kind of stupid. But if I can get it running on an actual Raspberry Pi, I will do that. All right. So, Quinn, you have the next thing, something about the Navy.
Yeah, I came across this. I thought it might be of interest to RCR folks. So this came up on HAD recently, Hackaday. It's a reader bought on eBay this is very catchily named, as is tradition with the military. It's a CP142/SPN-5A radar ranging computer. And it's a really amazing piece of analog computing technology, if you have any interest in that. So he bought this thing on eBay, took it apart, figured out mostly how it works, and has a nice write-up on it that we can link to. And he has beautiful photos of it if you're interested in old analog computing. So this thing officially dates from the early Korean War, but it's probably basically end of World War II technology. There was a lot of overlap there. So it's essentially state-of-the-art World War II stuff. And what it appears to do is it's designed to be connected to an analog radar computer. And this thing takes in a signal from that radar, computes a range, and then sends it back out again. And because it's analog, so analog radar uses sine and cosine waves for X and Y coordinates on the radar screen. And so this thing takes in a cosine signal and they think puts out a transformed one, essentially, to figure out what the range is of a blip. So you set this dial until the radar does something, and then you know how far away the blip is, essentially. So, but the construction of it is really something. It's about the size of a toolbox. It's all very heavy steel. Inside is vacuum tubes, very large components, point-to-point connections, no circuit board. It looks a lot like a 1940s era Philco radio inside, same construction techniques. It's all wire laced. If you've seen this technique they do in older aircraft, and I think they probably do it in some mainframes as well from the period, where the wiring is all wrapped in cotton string in a way that sort of connects. So it looks like a bunch of zip ties, but it's actually connected runs of cotton string. It's a very, very labor intensive technique, but it's very, very pretty. And when you don't have zip ties, I guess that's how they did it. So it's a great read. There's a lot of really cool mechanisms in it. I think it's worth a look if you like this old analog stuff.
At first, I thought when you were linking to this, it meant that you had come into possession of a range computer. And I thought, this is just not going to end well for anybody in California. I was like, oh, goodness. I was happy when I read this through that the person is not going to be like they say at the very end, that normally at the end of something like this, they'll think, well, what can I rip out of it and what would make neat dials and stuff? But they say, nope, it's going to stay whole and go on a shelf. And I'm like, oh, well, that's a much better result.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually this ends with, oh, and I made it into a Pandora radio with an Arduino on my desk. And you just cry because they've ruined this amazing piece of history. Amazingly, it seems to still work. All the tubes seem to work. There's a dozen vacuum tubes in it that all seem functional. Apparently, this thing sat on a shelf for 65 years, and the guy figured out what voltages it needed and what inputs, and it seems to have just fired right up. Amazing.
Huh. I wonder if there's anybody that used one that could be talked to.
Yeah, there's some, and if you read the comment threads in this post, there are some folks who used similar things or who were in the military sort of not too far after this. And so they have some familiarity with similar systems, but I don't know that they have anyone who's actually used it. It's pretty cool that it is electronic. You know, I think in World War II, most of the targeting computers were all actually mechanical. And there's some amazing videos online if you're interested in analog mechanical computing, all cams and gears and things to calculate trigonometry tables and things. But this thing is basically, it's the exact same principle of operation as a mechanical analog computer just done with vacuum tubes. You know, the physics is actually the same, the math is actually the same, which is pretty cool. So, yeah, this is kind of very near the peak of analog computing before people ran out of ideas and we had to do all this fancy digital stuff.
Yeah, but the world is much quieter for it, I think.
For sure.
Okay, Carrington, you have the next thing.
This is just a little quick one. A Steve Jobs job application surfaced recently, and somebody has scanned it and stuck it online. And so just in case everybody missed it, or missed, if they were wondering, back in 1973, would you hire this person? No, you would not. So this is his scribbled, kind of partially misspelled nonsense of a job application from the person who was supposedly really into details and design and such, and clearly had a disdain for this form. So Stephen Jobs, lowercase J, at Reed College, phone, none. Access transportation possible but not probable. Says he's in English lit, doesn't capitalize either of those. Looking for a job. Nobody knows what the job was for, but here it is. I get this kind of thing at work sometimes, resumes of roughly this quality. I will say it rarely leads to employment opportunities. But you can see Steve Jobs is, no doubt this is just surfaced so that somebody can sell it or stick it on eBay or an auction site or what have you, but you can take a look at a scan without paying a dime by heading over to rcrpodcast.com and checking the show notes.
Nice. Yeah, that's pretty.
He is skilled in computer and calculator, but not key punch or typing.
Yes, right. And it's to be qualified as design and tech, not use, apparently.
Right, yeah, design of calculators, not necessarily their actual function.
I guess this is the Apple version of that Microsoft photo that went around. It's like a photo of the founding members of Microsoft from the 70s, and they all look like bums because it was the 70s and they were 20-somethings, and the caption is something along the lines of, would you hire these people or whatever? It was a popular meme for a while.
Yep.
All right. Jack, you have Qbert news.
Yeah, so I saw this pop up everywhere. For me, reports of an AI finding a novel way to beat the classic Qbert video game. And basically, this is one of these things we've talked before about various products where someone sets an AI up running Atari 2600 games, playing through them, learning how to actually increase the score. And this is one of those. But the interesting thing is they just seem to have found an interesting bug in the 2600 version of Qbert, whereby apparently by fiddling with the joystick in certain ways during like a level end sequence or something, in certain conditions, you can just rack up points. And I found a forum thread in Atari Age. People were talking about this, and people are saying that they remember having seen this, like they've triggered it. They couldn't exactly determine exactly what they did to trigger it, but they remember that it's something that existed. But it seems like just whatever this sort of evolutionary algorithm that they're using happened to find the great way to do it, and so it can trigger the bug every single time and rack up points.
That's awesome. You'll see that in Super Mario AI programs as well, the genetic algorithms that are iterating on the solution, and yeah, they'll find all sorts of bugs that let them jump through entire levels and things.
It'd be sort of handy to have this around in the initial testing phase.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it makes you think of, I remember for Palm OS, there was some kind of software you could run that would like just sort of simulate tapping everywhere. Like you set up, you know, say, okay, give me 100,000 taps, and it taps the screen 100,000 times in random spots. This is along those lines, but then worse because it actually notices what actually has an effect and iterates further on that and digs into what's actually going on. So yeah, interesting anyway.
There's the theory that since there's only one real universe and essentially an infinite number of emulated universes, we are more likely to be in a simulation of some sort. And I guess if we're in a simulation of some sort, we're most likely to be in a simulation that was launched to do something like this. And you
just
wonder
hit
if
every point on the screen.
Really just it's like they're looking down and it's like, yep, nope. And so there's some old arcade game sitting someplace in some mall, and the whole purpose of everything was to test out, you know, that version of Space Invaders. And just we've just been left running for a bit extra. Maybe our universe is running over a weekend.
Maybe it's not even looking for bugs. Maybe it's some form of A/B testing. Like it's trying to find out which has the better user experience.
I see.
It is almost certainly not ours.
Right, exactly.
Well, you know, Carrington, there's another theory that that says that whole our universe is a simulation theory is silly, and it's correct.
Is that the other theory?
Yeah, and it's correct.
And is that your theory?
Yeah, no.
But it's one you subscribe to.
The whole simulated universes thing is a whole lot of naval nerd gazing. Nerd naval gazing is what I was going for there.
You may misunderstand the purpose of our podcast. And in fact, all podcasts.
I suppose a co-host of a retro computing podcast shouldn't be casting stones at nerd naval gazing. Let's talk more about the minutia of accelerator cards from 40 years ago.
Right. All right, so one last thing to note. This is a very small little news item, but it depends on who you are, whether it's small or not, I suppose. But Ben Edwards, who we've mentioned as, you know, writing various things that we've linked to along the way, and also the creator of a really pretty interesting new podcast whose name I've already forgotten, but it's good. History of Tech, is that right? Culture of Tech.
Culture of Tech, yeah.
Culture of Tech.
Very good podcast. But anyway, he posted a tweet at the end of, you know, like a week ago or something, a few days ago, that had a picture of like sort of a wall of vintage computers and says, does anybody want to buy a computer collection I've been gathering since 1993? Apparently he's considering moving. This is a lot of stuff to move, and he's trying to figure out what to do, basically. he ends it with the question, want to start a museum? Which, of course, makes all the people who actually run museums think, this is a harder thing than you think. But, so, yeah, I just kind of wanted to mention this. He's got a great collection. He's done a tour of it for Patreon backers at some point, which, unfortunately I missed it. It was actually like a live, like he would introduce you to, you know, whatever was at hand, behind him. And there was a live time you could go and do that, but I was like not available at whatever time that was. So you can still see it in the Patreon backlog or, you know, whatever it is, archive. But yeah, I mean, like whatever, he's got a lot of, you can even see in this photo, there's a lot of fancy stuff there. I'm sure it will be taken care of, but it does sound like he's looking to find someone else who would take, you know, at least possession of it. So
yeah, getting rid of a large collection like that is extremely challenging. A large collection of anything, I mean, you're basically, your choices are try to part it out on eBay, which is extremely labor and time consuming, or unload the whole thing at basically fire sale prices just for the convenience of getting rid of all of it quickly. Mm-hmm. Or frankly, just giving it away if you can find someone to take it.
Right, right. And I'm sure he'd find it, he would like for people to be able to see these things, you know. So the comments, you know, there's a fairly long thread. And, you know, in general, mostly I think people see something in that, on those shelves that they want, and want the one thing, you know, which is not, wasn't the initial goal. And, you know, I'd love to help, but I'm, you know, drowning in this stuff. I'm like, I need to do this too. So, but
anyway. Perhaps for our eBay section from now on, we'll all just choose one thing from a Ben Edwards photo.
Yeah.
Right. It's okay, Benj. I want seven things over, one thing up from shelf number four.
Right. Anyway, I hope this goes well. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's an emergency, but it does sound like he's considering, you know, what the next step is if he's going to move. So,
eventually, everything will just be with Paul, right? Like that's we're eventually going toward that. Like just right. Over a long enough time frame, all retro computing devices will be in Paul's office. Yes. That is, in fact, the simulation that we are running.
Right.
This is basically what happened to Sean Fahey, right? I mean, he had accumulated this incredibly large Apple II collection over the years from mostly free stuff people were giving away, and then was forced with having, you know, needing to get rid of it, and hence the garage giveaway at KFest happened just, you know, for no other reason to find a way to get rid of this stuff in a way that wasn't throwing it away.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think it's tough when you have stuff like printers, you know.
It's like nobody wants to even pay the shipping to, yeah. for that. But you really, like, you can't bear to put them in. So what you're going to wind up with is just like all the computers that nobody wanted and a bunch of printers.
You yeah. got to stick them on eBay and call them 2D printers. And I hope people misunderstand and buy them all.
Yeah. Actually, I think maybe what I'll do is I'll find something that's really, like, desirable and collectible. And then with every, you know, every whatever it is, like, you know, Ultima 2 or something, you also get an image writer.
Imposed on you.
Yeah. Printers and monitors. Oh, they're so heavy. Impossible to ship.
Okay. Anyway, I think that's it for the items of interest and news. There is a couple of upcoming shows that got announced that we can talk about. So there is the first one in our list, which someone has put in our show notes with a big green new.
That was me. I wasn't sure of how to make sure it was noticed as being new. That yes. would do it.
So we got this actually over feedback. The Home Computer Museum will be opening in the Netherlands on March 16th. I forget where it is. We were told.
Sure, it's on the website. And the Netherlands is small.
Anyway, yeah, it's I think so. From what I remember, anyway, from reading the email, it's focusing probably primarily on like the home computer, so like 1977 on kind of stuff. But if you are in the Netherlands, it's not that big. No matter where it is, you can get to it.
Nothing's far from anything in the Netherlands.
Right. So, homecomputermuseum.nl. Also, the Vintage Computer Federation have announced a VCF dates for a number of upcoming shows and the speakers for VCF East. So first one is VCF Southeast 6.0. That's April 21st to 22nd in Roswell, Georgia. All of these things are at vcfed.org. VCF East, what is that, 12? 13? I think it's supposed to be 13, but I wrote 12. So it's VCF East Next is May 18th to 20th at the VCF Museum in Wall, New Jersey. And they have speakers for that. So Bill Dromgoole will be talking about UNIVAC 1219-B restoration. Don Isles will be talking about the Apollo guidance computer. And Dave Walden will be talking about ARPANET and related things. So that will be interesting. So go to that if you can. And then VCF West 13 has been announced as being August 4th to 5th at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. Sometime, but not a lot of time between now and when these start happening. And then Tandy Assembly also has announced dates October 13th to 14th in Springfield, Ohio. So I think that's it for shows. And I think that's it for news. So without further ado, a word from our sponsor.
I'm Qbert, and I've got all the right moves. I've got the legs, too. First an arcade game, now my own home video game. I'm ready for anything. Staying away from creeps like Ugg and Coily takes a quick mind and lots of fancy footwork. The longer I hop around, the more they're out to get me. Ugg! When they said fame would go to my head, they weren't kidding.
Now for all popular systems.
Not easy being Qbert, but it's fun.
The National Museum of Computing needs £50,000 to keep the Turing Welshman bomb on the Bletchley Park estate. The bomb is a working reconstruction of the machine that helped break enemy Enigma messages in the Second World War. The museum is funded solely by private donations, entrance fees, and sales. It needs your help to raise £50,000 to install the bomb and prepare a display area worthy of such a historic machine. Please, help us ensure that future generations of students and visitors from across the world can marvel at and be inspired by the Turing Welshman bomb. Please make a donation today to keep the bomb on the Bletchley Park estate.
And we're back. So I am in charge of the host's retro competing gift idea, and the gift idea I have is that Target is selling an Oregon Trail handheld game. So you probably, if you've been paying attention to the internet recently, you will have heard of this. It's a little handheld thing that plays Oregon Trail. I think it's probably based on the DOS version, but it's brand new. I mean, like they I came to this recording from two different targets in order to try to get a hold of one. And the second one, I got them to go out back and, like, you know, find it in their warehouse because it hadn't actually made it to the floor yet. But so unfortunately, it took so long that I'm holding the box, but I have not tried it out. But at any rate, it's it basically is just a little it's a little handheld thing. It has the shape of sort of like a classic Mac in a way. Like there's a kind of like a disc, which I suppose is probably the like the on off switch or something. And it has a little screen, which is, I don't even know how many inches that is, but it's probably like 2.5 inches across, like diagonally. And it has some sort of directional pad. It has yes, no, and enter keys. And so anyway, I'm kind of curious to see it. And maybe, in fact, I will, while other people are talking, I will open it up and see if I can make it go. But it's only
the first RCR unboxing audio.
Right. Audio, great. well, I bought two, so if I mess up the first one. Anyway,
of course, yeah, you have two.
They're $25, basically.
And is it a color screen or a mono screen?
Well, the picture of it on the back is in color.
The screen shots actually look quite nice. Like, it looks like the sort of Apple II artwork, but it's full color and without the fringe. So it actually looks pretty cool in the photos that I've seen.
And it's cheap enough that you can get it without feeling too guilty. It is a monotasker, you know, and you can always play Oregon Trail in many other ways. But I mean, even on your phone in a much smaller form factor, but it's still cool.
I think this is a much cooler way to play Oregon Trail.
I agree.
Right.
And yeah, it is in color. I found some video walkthroughs on YouTube. It's all colorful and beautiful. Pretty amazing.
If anyone finds a reverse engineering of it, which I'm sure someone will do, please let me know, because I'd like to know what's in it. I assume it's a microcontroller, but I'm wondering if it's emulating something or if someone has just written a version of Oregon Trail for the, you know, Atmel 368 or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I suspect the latter, because that would be the cheapest way to do this, but I'd be interested to know if someone can dump the ROM from it.
Well, I think... I wasn't following it super, super closely, but I think at Foon, FOONE on Twitter, was going through it, like opened it up and looked a little bit at what was inside. So I think if you go check that feed, you might see some information about that.
Cool.
So he was the one that actually was also speculating that it was based on the PC version. Mm. Okay. Anyway, so that's pretty cool. Maybe as the eBay things proceed, I will open this up and try it out. But in the meantime, Carrington, you have the first eBay auctions.
I selected a Heathkit model, the H89. It's rare. It's new is really neither of the... Well, okay, you know what? It's not rare, but it is new looking. It caught my eye because it is obscenely new. In the thumbnail photo, I thought... It's got a weird glow to it. It looks like it's photoshopped or something. Why didn't they put an actual photo of? Oh my goodness, it's the actual photo. So it is a remarkably clean, looks like pretty much unused version of the old Heathkit 8-bit, the H89. Probably the H, what was it? The H8 is the more famous one, the one that looks like just a big calculator type thing. But this is the one that looks more like a Model 3 or Model 4 from Tandy. It's that sort of style. I've always liked that kind of form factor, although I have no personal experience with the H89, although I did have a Heathkit back in the day. This is asking $450 by it now, which is dear, but nothing is worth anything on eBay. I don't think anybody should buy any of it. Stop. You'll end up like Benj or Paul. Learn from the error of their ways.
Right.
But if you're going to invest in an H89, you could do worse than this one. It is very pretty. And I like the form factor. And it's functional. So working, beautiful, looks brand new. If you want one of these things, you're probably not going to do better. So there you go.
Yeah. It's and it doesn't cost anything to ship because they don't ship it. Looks like.
Oh, there's no shipping? Mine just says no shipping in Canada, but I just kind of always assume that.
Yeah.
You know, Carrington, your deep-seated terror of physical possessions, I think, is a manifestation of a fear of commitment.
And that is actually correct.
You should get some help for that.
I wish other people could just understand I don't want help for that. I'm very happily broken.
Then you shouldn't judge others for having different life choices.
Oh, yes, I should.
Everyone finds happiness in their own way.
That's actually true. Okay, I'm going to give you all that. Quinn's right. Whatever.
So what is this other... You linked to something else, the SEB.
Oh, if you're digging on these things, I wanted to look up a bit about them to remind myself, okay, which this is an 8-bit, right? And like, what was it? Because these stuff is so old. And because of that, I came across the SEBHC, the Society of 8-Bit Heathkit Computerists. And of course there's one of those. So we'll link to that in the show notes too. And it's a neat looking website. It seems like a gathering of maybe 8 people. and that is the entire market for these computers. But whatever, they're happy. I'm not judging their lifestyle because that's not a thing I do anymore.
Exactly.
So we will link to that as well. But because if you're into these or you're looking for like-minded people, then you will find them members of this society of 8-bit Heathkit computerists. I just like it. So they're the Sebhuk.
Props for that title. That is the best title of a retro computing group I've ever seen.
It is good, yeah. Certainly better than Retro Computing Roundtable. I have so many problems with RM name.
Retro Compute. Oh, yeah. Shoot.
Yeah. See, that would have been a great podcast name. If we had been the Society of Computerists. Oh.
All right. That's soon.
We would be even more famous than we already are.
Yes. Is that possible? Yes, it is possible.
I think it's inevitable, in fact.
Well, I have gotten my little device is now beeping at me.
Ooh.
So that's kind of good. I just wanted to...
It's beeping at all of us, actually.
Yeah, no, I know. Does it sing?
Is that like... Does it blend? Well, you're about to be YouTube famous, baby. Does it sing?
I mean... I was just thinking, like, it might be, you know, it might be interesting if there was a song it could play at least. But if it's just going to beep, then that's not very interesting to listen to.
See, if they had said that to Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak back in the day.
If only.
Right.
If only.
So much Atari teasing could have been prevented.
Yep. Right. We don't need sound, and one joystick should be enough for anybody.
That's right. You don't have friends.
You don't have friends.
You spent all your money on an Apple II.
All right, enough of this. Well,
riveting radio, Paul.
It works. It works and it's cool.
I think that beep might get old.
It did, yep.
All right, so anyway, so here we are. We're on to... Does anyone else have any eBay auctions?
No.
How many
no.
do you have, okay. Paul?
We don't talk about eBay on my podcast.
Right. Thing one, I thought was interesting. I'm not going to get it, but I thought it was interesting that it existed. It is a Osborne computer desktop personal accessory car connector. It is a cigarette lighter adapter for your Osborne.
Of course.
How many cars do you have to plug it into?
These still exist in cars, don't they? I mean, you can't actually like start a fire with them anymore.
No, they do not.
What? No. I mean, like, isn't there like a, whatever this is, 512, whatever, however many volts, little cylindrical plug?
That's what everybody uses to get USB adapters in their car.
Yeah, yes, they still exist.
So you could still use this if you had your Osborne. Actually, it looks to me like you could use this with anything, because really what it does is it turns your, you know, whatever it is, cigarette lighter adapter, into a regular sort of standard plug. So.
Yeah, it would have to be, I was just going to say, it would have to be an AC inverter, because the Osborne has an actual CRT in it, so they need high voltages. And those inverters are historically, or notoriously, I should say, awful.
Aha. Uh-huh. So
don't work.
You can use your Osborne in the car for a little bit until the whole thing catches fire.
Yeah, you can still buy them if you want to run 120 volt stuff in your car, but yeah, they're unreliable and they die after a few uses, and yeah, they're all terrible.
Oh well. Interesting anyway.
This one's vintage and terrible, so.
Yeah. That's right. So let's see, the next thing that I didn't say without how much it costs, but they want you to spend $65 on it or make an offer on it. But so the next one I had, I thought it looked really pretty cool. You know, I saw a little picture. It's an MSX computer, so a Toshiba HX10D 64K MSX computer. It has little joysticks with it. And the thing I like about this most, probably, that sort of caught my attention was the colors on the keyboard. So it's got, it's basically sort of like a, you know, whitish, off-white sort of main keyboard, and it has Japanese characters on it. But then the key, there's a red stop key, and the F keys are all sort of brown. There's a green graph key, and the arrow keys are blue, and it just looks very, very sort of pleasant. And I thought, oh, I should get this. You know, it's 137 starting bid. And then I thought, wait, and I have one already. So apparently I had all of these same thoughts before. Like, oh, I like that keyboard. I should get this. So this one I instead put in the list of and actually I haven't tried it because it does, you know, I don't have the power. It has I need to get a power converter for it, because it's, you know, whatever, it's the European two-prong thing. But it is really nice looking, and there's something just super charming about having Japanese characters on the keyboard.
Yep, it's cool looking.
Has anyone of you used MSX computer at all?
No, I'd like to, though. They have nice graphics for the period.
Yep.
Yeah. I know almost nothing about them. I got actually a pretty nice set, you know, the one that looks just like this. Mine is actually not it's an HX10 and not an HX10D, and I'm not sure what the exact difference is, but it actually came with a sort of matching cassette deck for playing the cassettes on, and a few cassette games and things. I'll have to try it out as soon as I can figure out how to plug it in.
The fact that you know yours, the one that you have, is a different model is the only thing that convinces me that this isn't one of the things where people are just sneaking into your office, posting stuff on eBay, right. You're rebuying your own stuff.
Right.
Because I swear I think that actually happens. And if I lived near you, it would absolutely be a thing that happens.
Right.
That's how we would fund this podcast.
And it would be, yeah, right. And it would be convenient for me as well, because there's always going to be a perfectly sized space to put it for some reason.
Paul's office is just a giant retro computing FIFO.
Right. Okay. Next thing I had, it is a Jumpman cassette for the IBM PC. It specifically is supposed to be compatible with even the 5150. So IBM PC, PC XT, or portable PC, or PC Junior. I think it does require color, but it's, oh, did I say it was a cassette? I don't know if I did. But it isn't. It's a disc. It's an IBM PC disc. It's in this case that looks like a monster cassette case.
So, right.
I mean,
weird thing.
It looks exactly like a cassette case, except that it turns out that, like, if you put it next to a 5 1/4 inch disc, it's the, you know, it can hold the disc inside it.
How do you know it's not a normal cassette holder and a teeny tiny disc? Because I think it's a little tiny floppy disc.
It's very strange. But I thought, so I think this is actually relatively uncommon. I don't pay that much attention to PC stuff generally, but I don't think of Jumpman as being a PC game.
I think it was relatively popular on the PC Junior. That was where I had played it back in the day. I had friends that had PC Juniors, and they all played Jumpman. So I think it may have been one of the kind of signature titles for that particular machine. It played really well on the PC Junior. I would go so far as to say it's the definitive version of Jumpman, vastly superior to the crappy Atari one.
I find that hard to believe.
Right.
I just want to see how much it takes to get Kevin Zavitz and Rob McMullen to write in.
Yeah, right. But
in all caps.
I actually do not really remember the Apple II one, except that I sort of had this sense that it wasn't very good. It was not the better of the Jumpman ports.
No, not at all. I played it after the PC Junior one and was deeply disappointed.
Yeah, the Apple one is not a good version.
Terrible.
But it's also, I mean, like, it's being compared to Apple Panic and, you know, Lode Runner and stuff, where, like, we have good ones.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but Jumpman is such a good game. Like, it's such a good platformer that I was definitely jealous. Even having Lode Runner, I was definitely jealous of my friends with Jumpman on the PC Junior, because it is such an interesting and well-designed game.
Yeah, I was completely dismissive of Jumpman, because I'm like, oh, that's going to be some terrible version of Lode Runner. Nope. Actually a really good game, just wasn't a good version on my platform of choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the way that every level had a different thing about it was really awesome. Like, that was so much fun. You never knew what the next level was going to be like. Like, Lowrunner, you know, the mechanics were set, and every single level was just a minor iteration of those mechanics. And Jumpman was, you know, constant variety.
Yep, it's pretty great. I still want to get back into my Jumpman level editing, and I have an idea for a cool custom level that requires some custom coding that would be fun to figure out. One of these days I'll find time, I'm sure. I keep telling myself.
Yeah. That is the thing. That is the most annoying thing about this. Like, I have so many projects I want to do.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, yeah, I didn't say anything about this, but the Jumpman disc is $25. Buy it now. Doesn't seem too crazy. I haven't seen them before, but I it's possible that maybe all the PC stuff just goes in some other stream that I don't see, because I see very rarely any PC stuff go by. And this looks like it's in pretty good shape. So, next thing is an Atari portfolio with a Network 8000 ASD interface. Jack, do you have one of these? I think we've talked about these before.
No, I don't. I keep thinking about picking one up, and I see them for sale now and then, but I have not yet gotten one. And this network interface, I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, well, that was the thing that actually made me kind of pick it. So it's the portfolio is a little, you know, sort of like handheld DOS machine, it looks like, essentially, but by Atari. This particular one, I believe, has intact hinges, which I think is one of the things that always breaks on these.
Yeah.
I don't know what the internal storage is. It has some kind of internal drive.
I think you actually stick a RAM card into a slot on the side, and it's some sort of powered RAM that actually has batteries that can die, that sort of thing.
Oh, that's not cool. So it's not like a Newton thing or whatever.
I don't think so. There are modern replacements that are actually flash RAM.
Okay.
Yeah, that was really common back in the day to have like an SRAM that was just running on batteries. Often there'd be two sets of batteries, and you would, you know, as long as you only changed one set at a time, it would maintain the SRAM. Mm. Or some systems had a clever battery layout where if there'd be four AA's, and as long as you only pulled out one AA at a time while you were replacing them, then it would maintain the memory.
So this particular thing, does start up. Looks like a pretty good portfolios go, but it has this network interface, and it's really quite unclear. It says, you know, there's a sort of fuzzy picture that says Network 8000 and then ASD bus interface, I think is what it says. And as far as I can tell, this is some kind of interface between this little portable Atari portfolio and like environmental building, you know, like control. I'm pretty sure that this Coleman company and the Network 8000 is like something that runs like air conditioners and things. It's very weird. So I bet there aren't many of these interfaces, and it might be interesting to see what it is.
Yes, maybe it's the thing where you could have, if you didn't have a proper sort of network between your buildings managing your facilities, you'd have an access port in a building somewhere, and you could take a computer and go plug it into it to set things up.
Yeah.
And do this in a portable way. Interesting.
Was this the computer that was in whatever movie that was in, like the Terminator?
Terminator 2, yeah. Yeah, it was, right? Yeah.
Yep.
So
we hacked the ATM.
So perhaps they were using a Network 8000 ASD interface.
Interesting. I was actually just the other day reading a book by Neil Gaiman, a collection of his nonfiction speeches and things, where he actually mentioned in the 90s pulling out his little battered Atari palm top computer to type something up. I was like, wait a minute, he was using a portfolio.
Nice. I think he lives in Minnesota too, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So, all right. Many connections.
Yep.
Oh, and we somebody, you know, from Minnesota did something, you know, in cross-country skiing and in the Olympics, and there was a little ad that they would play. At least in my market, it was an Xfinity ad. So I'm not sure if it was a general market one or not, but it actually showed basically people sitting and watching this person perform Olympic events or whatever in a little cafe that's like a block away from the house where I grew up. So that was kind of pleasing to see. I'm like, oh, wait, I know that cafe.
That's how I feel watching Cool Runnings, the Disney movie about the Jamaican bobsled team that was entirely shot in Calgary and largely on the UFC campus where I went to school. I'm super annoying to watch that movie with because I have to point out everything that I know.
Right. Yeah, it's cool to be able to see those things. It does take you out of it a little bit.
Yeah, it does. Like, oh, that's not a fantasy. That's just a place I know.
Right. Okay, let's see. The last auction. I've seen this before. I don't think I've pointed it out on the podcast before, but I know I've tweeted about it before. But someone is selling. It's one of the feelies from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Infocom game. And so it's like a little plastic bag, and it says on the top, "Official Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Microscopic Space Fleet." And it's a joke of it's microscopic, you can't tell. But what I like about the name of this auction is that it says bag only, so it doesn't actually include the microscopic space fleet. It's just the bag.
Useless.
Honestly, this person should be charging $1,000 for this, because if you don't know what it is and you're not going to buy it anyway. But if you're that one person out there who has a Hitchhiker's Guide and is missing just this feely out of the set, you will pay anything to get it.
So. Yeah.
I am currently, as I speak, holding this thing in my hand because we just recorded the Hitchhiker's episode of Eaten by a Gru. And so I still have the box beside me from when we were going through the feelies. So it's like, literally, open it up. Here it is, microscopic fleet, space fleet, although my staple is through the words Hitchhikers and Guide. So my staple is less nicely positioned than the one in this auction. I don't know if that means I'm willing to spend, $10 for the upgrade. In fact, I am not, but there you go.
Does yours have the fleet in it, though?
It does. Mine still contains the fleet.
Okay, so you could just transfer the fleet to a better bag.
Right. Absolutely, yes.
That's common in collecting.
Or have it eaten by a dog.
Yeah, they call it upgrading the packaging. It's pretty common.
Let's see. What else is there? There's a don't panic button, and there's the glasses.
There's the glasses, which are basically just a piece of cardboard cut and shaped glasses. There's also a piece of fluff
here
in my hand. There's a little baggie with a piece of white fluff. And then the rest is just the browsy and the regular Infocom little cards and stuff, the disc and the warranty card and such.
The don't panic button is actually – that's pretty hard. That's relatively hard to get. Like I've had – I think I probably have like three of these sets and one don't panic button, because that's the one thing that everybody takes out and like used in the whatever in the 80s, and so it wound up not staying with all the sets.
Ah, yes, mine has it. It's just an orange button with words "Don't Panic" on it in yellow, so it's not actually that exciting a button.
No, but nevertheless, people I guess would actually wear them back when they didn't realize that the thing they bought was collectible. All right. I think that's it for the eBay auctions. And now we're on to closing discussions, and nobody's written anything but me. But Carrington.
I have a thing that I did that was unique for me and maybe would be unique for a lot of the sorts of person who would listen to this podcast. I went to a beach. and that was a relatively unique experience. It's bizarre. My gal and I took the long weekend and went down to the Dominican Republic, and I did one of those go to a resort and sit on the beach things, which I have been dismissive of my whole life because how boring does that sound? And I actually really liked it. Turns out just like living a Kindle ad is quite fun. Sit and read and do nothing, because the internet is awful. The internet is awful, yes, but also the access there to the awful internet was also awful. Was actually a fun thing. I was surprised. So if it's the kind of thing that comes up as an opportunity in somebody's life, and you are also a pale nerd who fears the sun and keeps away from it, provided you put on SPF a billion and stay in the shade, it can be a really enjoyable thing. Surprise.
That connection to this podcast's content was extremely tenuous. Just saying.
Yes.
You just wanted to tell people you went to the Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
It's not a very exciting place, to be honest, but being out in the sun, hey, California girl, whatever.
Yeah. That was hit by a hurricane not too long ago, right?
I think it was not. Not badly, anyway. Okay. Not as badly as stuff to the east of it.
Okay. That's good. I mean, always good when you're not hit by hurricane, I guess. Jack, do you have any closing thoughts?
The only thing I want to say is I got a very cool device from a company called Teenage Engineering. They have these things called pocket operators that are these cool music synthesizers. And the one I got is called the Arcade, and it's all built around making sounds that sound like 80s arcade game, kind of like this.
Pretty fun. Cool.
Do you just walk around with a theme song now? People hear you coming.
I'm pretty jazzed about this thing. It's great.
As is your whole family.
Yes. Everyone's excited about this.
Yeah, and that's how Jack got annoying at work.
Put that thing down. We're trying to have a meeting over here.
Cool.
So that's it for me.
Yep. All right. I don't really have much to say. What I'd written down here was that I lost a bunch of auctions for CC40 peripherals, but I already mentioned that. So spring break has begun at the university that I work at, so that might mean, I don't know what that'll mean. Maybe I'll get something done. But otherwise, no, then nothing really for me to add either. Quinn, did you have any sort of closing thought?
A little bit of breaking retro news. I've been working on this Apple IIgs project, 65816 assembly, for many months. I'm hoping to show some of it at Kansas Fest this year. And literally an hour before we started recording, I fixed a bug that I've been working on for weeks, maybe even months. It's been driving me insane, and I fixed it, and it's the greatest feeling ever. And that feeling is why I'm a software engineer, and that feeling remains the same whether it's 1987 or 2018. So just thought I'd share that.
Cool.
So that's breaking news. How did it feel to scoop open Apple again?
Oh, gee, I did, didn't I? I got so close to getting through this show without scooping open Apple, and in the last few minutes, I did it anyway.
But at least this time, it's you scooping it, right?
Yeah, I suppose. You've won this round, RCR.
Right. It's basically just Mike that's left out at this point.
Yeah, Mike's going to... Oh, there's going to be beatings. Mike does not like it when I do this.
I don't see why you have to beat Mike because of it, but okay.
All right. Okay, then I think that's it. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast and join our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review in iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And so, until next time...
Retro-compute!
I recorded.
I recorded.
I started recording like 10 minutes in.
I didn't record any of this.
Retro-compute!